Good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us on the line Mr. Edward Klein. He's written a fascinating book called The Truth About Hillary, What She Knew, When She Knew It, and How Far She'll Go to Become President. Now, the book to me is important because Hillary Clinton may well be the next president of the United States. And the way things are going today, she's certainly positioning herself to run for the presidency, although she says she's not going to. Why, you know very well that she's not telling the truth, because she really hasn't told the truth about much of anything through the years. And Mr. Klein has done a wonderful job of cataloging her history, of talking to so many people who knew her and knew her very well. And most of them, well, they didn't seem to have too high an opinion of her, did they, Mr. Klein?
Please call me Ed, Dr.
Okay, Ed.
And you're right. No, they did not have too high an opinion of her.
Now, my understanding is that your book is really rather controversial. In fact, you had a number of television interviews all lined up. Would you mind telling our listeners a little bit about that?
Yes. This is my fifth best-selling book. And in the first four of them, I have been asked repeatedly to be on most of the television shows that your listeners are familiar with, the Today Show, Good Morning America, Larry King, CBS Morning News, the Fox and Friends, and all kinds of, even The View with Barbara Walters. And this time around, I was booked by these same shows, or many of these same shows, to be on as well. But when Hillary heard about this, she unleashed a barrage of phone calls through her own office and through her supporters, demanding that these television networks cancel my appearances, and if they didn't, that there would be some kind of a retaliation in terms of the access they'd have to Mrs. Clinton. And as a result, these TV networks all canceled my shows, to my utter amazement.
Well, I'm not amazed at all. In fact, I'm just so pleased, though, that you are getting onto talk radio and getting your message out that way.
I am, and it's wonderful that the networks and the mainstream media no longer monopolize the message that gets to the American people anymore.
Well, now, what is it about your book that makes it so different? Because ordinarily, you know, we do not find such an intentional effort to block information getting out. What is it about your book and what you reveal about Hillary that she's so frightened of getting out to the American people?
I think there are a couple of things at work here. One is that I am not a member of the so-called vast right-wing conspiracy. I'm not a well-known conservative writer. As a matter of fact, I'm not a well-known liberal writer either. I'm a registered independent and a person who's been a journalist with some very reputable journals all my life. So that's number one, and that gives my book a lot of credibility. The second thing is I think I've simply done more digging and more reporting and more thinking than anyone else has done yet about Hillary, and the result is that the truth, which should make us free, is making Hillary squirm.
We'll be back in just a moment with Ed. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest is Edward Klein, and he's written a wonderful book about Hillary. And, of course, one of the questions that is asked about Monica Lewinsky, and, of course, Hillary claimed that, oh, my goodness, I had no idea that my husband would be cheating on me. He lied to me. And the point that you make in your book is that really the reason that Hillary got elected senator there in New York was because of Monica Lewinsky and the way she handled that scandal. Would you want to pick up that thought? Because I think it's such an important point.
Yes, Dr. Stan. It was Hillary herself who was really responsible for hiring Monica Lewinsky. In the spring of 1996, Hillary received a phone call from a big Democratic Party donor by the name of Walter Kaye asking her for a favor. And the favor was, would you please hire the daughter of a friend of mine? And that daughter's name was Monica Lewinsky. So Hillary called the Democratic National Committee and asked them to hire Monica, and they did, as an unpaid intern at the White House. And when she showed up, Monica, at the White House, she found that Hillary had, from the very beginning of the Clinton administration, stationed outside the Oval Office one of her chief aides, whose primary responsibility was to keep an eye on the president and his predilection for women. And in fact, this aide's nickname was Mother Superior, because she was acting like a Mother Superior. It became clear to Mother Superior that Monica and the president were up to no good, and she told Hillary, and they transferred her to the Pentagon. This happened in 1996, in the spring of 1996. It was in 1998 that the Washington Post broke the scandal of the Monica Lewinsky being in the Oval Office with the president and the stained dress and all of that. Hillary went on television and told Matt Lauer on the Today Show that she believed her husband when he said that he didn't have an affair with Monica, and that it was all a vast right-wing conspiracy, which was a total lie because she had known about it for 2 years. And then she went on to say a few months later that he confessed to her and she was shocked by his confession, which was also a lie. And then finally she tried to convince the American people that she and her husband were estranged over this, when in fact they were...
Hold that thought for just a moment, please, okay, as we bring our stations back on. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest is Stephen Ed Klein. The book, The Truth About Hillary, What She Knew, When She Knew It, and How Far She'll Go to Become President. And Ed was simply saying that Hillary had known, for a long time about Bill's affair with Monica Lewinsky. In fact, she had a woman stationed just outside the Clinton's office, known as Mother Superior, and she was keeping tabs on Bill and Monica. And so in 1996, Hillary and Mother Superior had Monica transferred over to the Pentagon. It was 2 years later when the story broke, and Hillary then comes out and said why she had no idea. And then when she did learn that it really was true, how estranged she was from Bill, and then, of course, her whole history, she knew about all of the philandering and all of the women, and she had kept track of all of Bill's infidelities. And so this was nothing new at all, was it, Ed?
No, it wasn't new. But what was new, Dr. Stan, is that the polls that the Clintons always took very frequently started showing that there was a lot of sympathy for Hillary as the wronged woman, that people felt sorry for her and that they saw her as a victim of this whole Lewinsky scandal and her husband. And as a result, she suddenly became, within a matter of a few weeks, wildly popular. And it was this popularity, this transformation from a unpopular, scandal-scarred First Lady to a victimized, quote-unquote, popular First Lady that allowed her to run for Senate in New York and win.
But I think it's really so interesting just to go in the background of Hillary, and she's not at all what she appears to be. And in fact, you comment that Bill actually found out that Hillary was pregnant by reading the newspaper. She leaked the story to the newspapers back in 1979 before she told her husband.
That's right. Bill was sitting there in the governor's mansion in Little Rock reading the paper, and he called the friend up and said, "You'll never believe this, but this is the first I've heard of it, but Hillary has just announced to the press that she's pregnant."
What sort of a marriage is this?
Well, exactly. I mean, that's why I tell this story in my book, because it really explains the truth about this marriage, which is, of course, that it's a marriage of convenience and political partnership, not a true intimate marriage in the eyes of God.
And certainly you go into the background of Hillary as a student at college, and the fact that many people felt that she was even more than a feminist, that she had some lesbian tendencies?
Well, it's hard to say because, you know, these things are very private, and I can't pretend that I was in the bedroom, so I don't pretend. But there's no doubt, according to her classmates, that Hillary was extremely interested in and studied very thoroughly the whole idea of the lesbian agenda while she was there in Wellesley College, that two of her roommates were, in fact, lesbians, that she adopted many of the lesbian political attitudes of the time. And whether or not she herself is a practicing lesbian, I can't say. Whether she's bisexual, homosexual, heterosexual, or for that matter, asexual, which may be likely. But we do know that she has embraced this radical gender feminism that is part of the lesbian agenda.
And, of course, the marriage to Bill really was sort of an unusual marriage. She wouldn't even take his name. And wasn't that sort of a problem for him running for political office when his wife wouldn't accept his name and wouldn't dress up like a woman?
It was certainly a huge problem. And it was this lesbianism began to haunt her in Arkansas, because when he ran for re-election and his opponents started talking about the fact that Hillary Rodham wouldn't even take the governor's last name, and that she dressed like a lesbian, spoke like a lesbian, because she was she was notorious for using foul language and behaved like one, and many, many voters thought she was. And as a result, Bill Clinton's campaign manager asked her to, you know, speak out about this and deny it, and she refused to do so. It was only after he lost that she finally realized she had to do a complete makeover, which she did, and emerged 2 years later as Mrs. Bill Clinton, dressed up, hair fixed up, and speaking in a much more feminine way.
So basically, it was really all a matter of image. Everything is a matter of perception, and really, when you're running for political office, the idea of a happily married family, a happily married couple, is so important, whether there's any real truth to it or not.
Well, that's exactly right. It's all image making. You know, getting back to these polls, the Clintons are poll obsessed, and sometimes you wonder whether they have any core values. I happen to think they do have core values, and I think those values are hard left values, very, very extreme left-wing values. But they often hide those values that they really believe in under the charade, or masquerade, I should say, of being a centrist and a moderate.
Now, of course, isn't Hillary really the driving force behind Bill's political career? Isn't she the one who's really sort of organized things behind the scenes to propel him forward?
Yes, Bill Clinton lost his first election to the Congress in 1974, and was wondering whether he would even continue in politics. And it was Hillary who more or less made it plain that if he wasn't going to be in politics, she wasn't going to be in Arkansas with him. She was going to leave him. And when he wondered about running for governor again, she said, if you don't run for governor, I will. And when he tried to run for president the first time around in 1988, she was the one who was egging him on because his chief of staff was saying, no, it's too soon, and these stories about his womanizing are to come back to haunt him. We've got to clean up this business of all these women and intimidate them to be quiet. So Hillary has been pushing and pushing and pushing for a bill to become president, and was really the iron in his spine.
Now, didn't she sort of have organizations for demonizing and attacking and vilifying and frankly destroying anybody who threatened Bill?
Yes. There was, I'm sad to say, a great deal of thuggery in Arkansas on Hillary's part. Anyone who dared speak out against Bill Clinton, especially the women who he abused, were frequently found themselves in a position where they were being literally threatened, physically threatened, and threatened with loss of jobs, loss of careers, exposure as loose women. People who came to investigate Bill Clinton's tenure as governor were often intimidated by these thugs that were loosed upon them. And there was a great deal of physical and psychological intimidation of their adversaries.
And certainly we know how she treated the people in the travel office and really how she treated the people in the White House. It was almost like everybody was dirt under her feet. And right. if they got in her way, she would destroy them. And she certainly destroyed the head of the travel office for no reason at all, and even had him indicted without any basis at all, and ruined his life.
One of the stories that's never been told, and I didn't have room for it in my book, is that during the primary campaign in 1992, the Clinton campaign ran short of money, and they took out a loan from Harry Thomason and his wife Linda Bloodworth Thomason. These are the producers from Hollywood who produce Hearts of Fire and other well-known television shows and made a lot of money. And when the Clintons then took over the White House, Harry Thomason came to them and said, you know, I happen to have, in addition to my TV production company, a travel agency. And I think it would be very nice, since I can do just as good a job as the travel office in the White House, if you would throw me that business. And they owed him big time for that loan. And that was the reason behind Hillary's order to fire the travel office.
No, but to get the head of it indicted, you know, for criminal activity, that was really rather crude. Why not just fire him rather than try to destroy him?
Well, because she always tries to destroy people who cross her. She's tried to do that with me in this book, The Truth About Hillary. She's had me attacked on all kinds of very disgusting levels, which I don't care to go into.
Well, I heard at least one of your interviews with someone, and I thought it was the way they treated you was very uncalled for. And even when I have dedicated people on my program I totally disagree with, I always try to be nice to them, and this fellow wasn't nice to you in the least bit. You handled yourself very graciously, though.
Thank you. I appreciate that, Dr. Stan.
Well, and of course, what about this use of illegal drugs? And perhaps we can get into that when we get back here in just a minute. But this is fascinating investigative journalism. Mr. Ed has done a tremendous job of talking to people and documenting his conversations. And an awful lot of people are willing to talk because they feel, as I do, that our country is in real jeopardy looking down the line to 2008. And perhaps Hillary is ascending to the presidency of the United States. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Ed Klein. We're talking about his book, The Truth About Hillary, and what she knew, when she knew it, and how far will she go to become the next president of the United States. Now, one of the most interesting things and perplexing things about the Clinton administration was the strange death of the Vince Foster. And you commented in your book how Hillary actually violated the law. The certainly Vince Foster's office was a crime site, at least part of the crime site. He had a lot of papers in there. And she sent her people down to rifle through the files there to get out things that might be incriminating for her that the police otherwise would have picked out. So do we have any idea what she wanted to hide, how she was able to get away with that? And there were many, many questions about the death of Vince Foster that really didn't quite add up.
Well, that's true. We still don't know to this day for sure that, number one, he committed suicide, or was he murdered, or number two, was the body moved from one place to another. What we do know, however, is that for 2 days after his death, Hillary ordered some of her closest advisors to seal the office, Vince Foster's office, from the FBI and the National Park Service police, while they cleanse the office of presumably incriminating material. What was that material? It's hard to say. It certainly must have had something to do with the Whitewater investigations, various Whitewater investigations, various use of FBI files, IRS documents that the Clintons used against their, you know, the tax returns against their enemies. There was a lot of evidence that had been collected regarding the use of prisoners in Arkansas, back in Arkansas, to donate blood for a few dollars, even though these prisoners were known to be HIV positive and had hepatitis C, and that this blood from the Cummins Penitentiary in Arkansas, while Bill Clinton was governor, this blood was distributed to various countries around the world and used for hemophiliacs. And in Canada, there is a huge lawsuit pending even to this very day as a result of the deaths of well over 1,500 hemophiliacs who had transfusions with this blood. It is my belief that among the incriminating documents are documents regarding this blood program in Arkansas.
In fact, one time I actually interviewed a fellow who'd written a book about that, the whole escapade, and he wouldn't use his own name. He was frankly afraid for his life after writing that book. So, you know, going into the background, because you're talking about the murder of those hemophiliacs, they knew the blood was tainted, and the hemophiliacs had to have it so they wouldn't have blades. And they simply killed them there, as they did the same thing in Japan, they did the same thing in France, but nobody has ever been held responsible, although there is a massive lawsuit on that.
Yes.
All right, fine. Well, then, of course, the question comes up. There were always sort of rumors, and they were always just rumors, that there might have been some special relationship between Vince Foster. Hold that line, Doc. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we've been talking about Hillary. We've been talking about the death of Vince Foster. And it was suggested that there were many, many things that Vince had in his files that could have been very embarrassing to the Clintons, perhaps records of Whitewater, records about the blood that had been taken from prisoners in the penitentiary in Arkansas and sold up in Canada that had killed 1,500 hemophiliacs and infected an awful lot of people with HIV and with hepatitis C, and they knew the blood was infected and was sold up there, and Vince Foster apparently was worried about that. He was worried about a lot of things, but then, of course, he dies and under very, very strange circumstances. Hillary refused even to let the FBI into his office until they cleansed the office and gotten all the records out, and, of course, this is totally illegal, but then These people are the president and the co-president of the United States. And then I raised the question about the strange relationship between Vince Foster and Hillary. We've heard all sorts of rumors. What did you learn by talking to people who knew about the relationship between Vince and Hillary?
Well, a couple of things. One is that it was an open secret among Hillary's circle of friends that she and Vince Foster were lovers. And it was just taken for granted that that was the case. So there was, it was not even a secret in Little Rock. However, that didn't, I was puzzled by that because it didn't seem to fit in with my profile of Hillary as either asexual or bisexual or a lesbian. And I wondered about that, and it, I came to the conclusion that since Vince Foster was used by Bill Clinton as essentially his enforcer in Arkansas, somebody who would go around making sure that people were towing the line, that it is not inconceivable that Hillary's relationship with Vince was in aimed at keeping him on the string. Apparently he was besotted by Hillary. It's very hard for me to believe that she was besotted by him, because I don't think Hillary is besotted by anybody. And I think that somebody who is obsessed with her as he was would be an easy prey for her if she kept him, as I say, on the string, sexually and otherwise. And I think that may be what explains that relationship.
All right. Under any circumstances, why Vince dies under very, very strange circumstances, and a lot of people who knew things about that were intimidated by the FBI, and apparently there were people within at least some government agencies that were going along with intimidating and threatening people, anybody who wanted to get to the truth of what really happened with Vince Foster, and we may never know the truth about that. So there were really so many strange scandals that beset our nation during the years when Bill and Clinton were in the White House. Now, you talk about how Hillary abandoned lifelong friends and political allies in an effort to moderate her liberal image and to make herself more acceptable for the coming race for the presidency in 2008. What's the background there?
Well, the background is that before her liberal supporters understood what she was up to, which is, as I say, this masquerade as a centrist, they thought that Hillary was abandoning them and actually refusing to, for instance, back certain bills that they wanted her to vote for. And a group of women whom I interviewed told me the stories of how they went down to Washington to urge her to vote for a child welfare bill, and she refused to do so because she said it wasn't going to pass. They said, well, we don't care if it passes or not. We want you to stand up for it the way Teddy Kennedy would stand up for it, and she got very upset with them and stormed out of the room. But now it seems to me that more and more liberals have wigged on to, if that's the right phrase, have caught on to what she's up to and are not quite as upset with her as they were at first when she got into the Senate. They realize that she is playing a game here. That, yes, she has turned her back on her far left wing stance on so many issues. For instance, she's pro-war, Iraq war. They can't stand the Iraq war, the liberals, and other things. But now that it's become clearer and clearer to them that she's doing this in order to make herself more acceptable to the larger electorate, I think they're beginning to learn to accept it.
And, of course, she's doing what Bill Clinton did, to project himself as a centrist, even though he was on the far left. That's and he did it very successfully, really.
Exactly.
All right, we're going to be back here in just a moment with Ed Klein. Fascinating book. We think the book is well worthwhile getting and well worthwhile reading. The Truth About Hillary, what she knew, when she knew it, and how far she'll go to become President of the United States. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, our guest is Ed Klein, and we're talking about his book on Hillary Clinton. Fascinating read, fascinating insight into a very, very intelligent, very capable, but very, very ruthless individual. Now, one of the stories that you tell is about her relationship to Mrs. Arafat, Yasser Arafat's wife, and all the problems this created, and then how she managed to placate the Jewish population of New York City after pictures were taken of her hugging the wife of the head of the Palestinian Liberation Organization. That was a fascinating story. Would you like to repeat it?
I'd be delighted. Hillary needed the Jewish vote in New York City, as does every Democratic candidate, to offset the Republican vote, the Jewish Democratic vote, to offset the Republican vote from upstate New York. And she was having a lot of trouble with the Jewish voters. And then when she showed up at Mrs. Arafat's speech, and Mrs. Arafat claimed that Israel was purposely gassing Palestinian women and children, and then Hillary, after the speech was over, applauded and went up to the podium and hugged and kissed her, Hillary was in jeopardy of losing that Jewish vote. And so suddenly she turned up a long lost great grandfather who she claimed was half Jewish and laid claim to some Jewish relative, this great great grandfather, as a way of trying to ingratiate herself with Jewish voters.
Now, you had another story here that about she was running against, of course, Rick Lazio, I guess that was that the Senate campaign?
Yes.
And, of course, how she leaked this story about an illegal stock transfer. No truth to it at all, but, of course, then he had to defend himself against a false charge. What was that all about?
Well, Hillary used Controller of New York State, who is a very close ally, Democratic ally of her, H. Carl McCall, to use his letterhead, his official letterhead, to write the Securities and Exchange Commission demanding that the SEC investigate her opponent, Rick Lazio, for some kind of stock fraud transaction. H. Carl McCall also sent a copy of this letter to the New York Times, which naturally printed it, because that would hurt Hillary's opponent, the Republican. And this put, as you said, Rick Lazio on the defensive for the remainder of the campaign, and he was only cleared of any wrongdoing after he lost the campaign.
Well, that's on.
Too late.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. We were just telling about some of Hillary's dirty tricks during the Senate race, where she got one of her friends to write a letter on his letterhead asking the Securities Exchange to investigate Rick Lazio, who was a Republican opponent. No truth to the story at all, but with the help of the New York Times, which, of course, is part of the liberal establishment, they were able to besmirch the name of her opponent, draw attention away from what the real issues were, and eventually, of course, Hillary became the junior senator from New York. Now, of course, she's used these sorts of tricks down through the years for all sorts of purposes. And you talk in your book a little bit about how she was actually involved in the original Watergate investigation. Would you like to cover that a little bit? Because that was, of course, when they were going after Richard Nixon. And how did she fit into that so many years ago?
In 1974-75, Richard Nixon was being investigated, as you know, for impeachable offenses. And Teddy Kennedy hoped to capitalize on this by running for president in 1976 after Nixon had been weakened. And Kennedy was able to organize his allies from his brother's administration, John F. Kennedy's administration, to actually staff the House impeachment inquiry. And one of the young lawyers who was on that staff was Hillary Rodham, who had been sent down to Washington by one of Teddy Kennedy's chief lieutenants. And when she got down there, Hillary's job was to come up with regulations that would prove that a president does not have the opportunity to cross-examine witnesses in an impeachment inquiry. And the reason for that was everyone on the Democratic side was afraid that Nixon's counsels, his attorneys, would cross-examine witnesses and prove that previous presidents, including John F. Kennedy himself, Teddy's brother, was guilty of far worse crimes and misdemeanors than Nixon, because Kennedy had, of course, okayed the assassination of foreign leaders as a method of foreign affairs. So Hillary was involved in that. She was also involved in Teddy Kennedy's strategy to keep Nixon in office as long as possible, twisting in the wind, losing support, weakening the Republican Party. It was only the Republicans who finally convinced Nixon to resign, because they needed to rebuild the party. But Hillary learned her dirty tricks early on in Washington during this Nixon impeachment inquiry.
And I really thought it was so interesting that you mentioned in one of the other programs that it was basically Senator Barry Goldwater who went to Richard Nixon and said, you know, you've got to resign, otherwise you'll destroy the Republican Party and make it obvious that the Democrats will take over everything in 1976. That was pretty smart on Goldwater's part, and at least from Nixon's point of view, he did, at that point, I think, the right thing for the country, don't you?
He did the right thing for the country, and I don't think he would have been impeached myself, but maybe he would have been. But you know, Nixon had a lot more conscience than Bill Clinton when it came his time to face impeachment, and he fought it tooth and nail, despite the fact that he had disgraced the office of the presidency.
And I think it's amazing he was able to survive the impeachment, and had it not been for a lot of help from some senators, even from some Republican senators, why, of course, he would have been thrown out of office.
And that's right.
All right, well, now, of course, there's so many stories that you tell about Hillary. The book is just really almost leads like a mystery novel in many respects, and the way you sort of build up. And one of the things really was so shocking is the fact that everybody in the White House that she came in contact with was afraid of Hillary. She'd make their lives miserable, and she, your language apparently would make even a sailor blush.
That's true. It's interesting that, you know, Hillary in public is this person who likes to present herself as someone in whose mouth butter wouldn't melt, but in fact, in whose mouth four-letter words come streaming out on a regular basis.
But they point out that she really will destroy her friends. I mean, she really has no permanent friendships. If one of her friends gets in the way, she destroys them just like she'll destroy anybody else.
That's true. And people who have seen this happen are intimidated by watching the way Hillary has destroyed a whole slew of people in Arkansas and in Washington. And I'm sure she will continue to do this if she's ever elected president.
Well, now, you point out that Bill Clinton was really very, very protective of her, and you had an opportunity to talk to George Stephanopoulos?
Yes, I have.
And he seemed to be really very, 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 very candid with you about Bill's willingness to protect Hillary from criticism.
Yes, I think that's true, and I think one of the reasons for that is that Bill really has never been able to handle Hillary. He's afraid of Hillary. I think she intimidates him. And part of the reason for that is that he's constantly walking around with a guilty conscience and doesn't feel that he has a leg to stand on with her. And, in fact, he doesn't.
But, of course, she's put up with all of his infidelities.
Well, that's something that he doesn't seem to get, which is that she's just as bad as he is. He doesn't seem to understand that she's... has she abided his philandering, she's abetted it.
And I really think that this, in fact, that she's always been there, though, to protect him whenever he got into a problem. Really, of course, what she was doing was protecting herself. Now, my understanding is when they got into the presidency, that she wanted to be the Attorney General, or she wanted, in fact, she even wanted Al Gore's office. She wanted to run everything in the White House.
Well, that's true. One of the arrangements they had as a result of her coming to his support during the Jennifer Flowers bimbo eruption in 1992 during the primary campaign, when it looked as though his career was over, and she appeared with him on 60 Minutes and supported him.
Is that when everything came crashing down? I've forgotten the lights came down and cameras came down.
Exactly.
It was almost as if it had been planned that way so that they'd have to stop the interview.
Yes. In any case, she extracted a promise in return from him that if he were elected president, that she would occupy the vice president's office. And indeed, when he was elected president during the transition, she demanded that office. And when Al Gore and Tipper Gore heard about it, they, of course, went bananas. And they had a big row about this, and Gore won that battle. But Hillary wouldn't give up. She then demanded the job of Attorney General until it was pointed out to her that there was a nepotism clause in the federal statutes that prevented the president from appointing a relative as cabinet member. And then she talked about becoming the chief of staff of the White House, and his political people talked her out of that because it would have been a huge embarrassment if the wife had been the chief of staff of the White House. So she settled for an office in the West Wing, but no First Lady had ever had an office in the West Wing, which is the policy wing of the White House. They had always been relegated to the East Wing, which is the social wing of the White House. But Hillary demanded an office in the West Wing. She was given one, and she had a huge staff, and that staff didn't have room in the West Wing, so they housed her staff next door in the old executive office building next door to the White House. And it was almost all women, a lot of very manly sort of women, I might add, and that place was called Hillary Land.
Well, you know, one of the things that really bothered me during the Clinton administration was all the people who kept dying under very strange circumstances. And I know you don't go into a lot of that, but certainly the death of Vince Foster, the death of Ron Brown, the death of Jim McDougal when he was in prison. I think there was a list of about 50 or 60 people who died under very mysterious circumstances.
Yes, and there's been a video made of that called the Clinton Chronicles, which you may have seen, and it goes into that at great length. I didn't have room to go into that in my book, and so I didn't have the opportunity to really examine that.
Well, Chris, what they did was they planted FBI agents all around Pat Matriciano, who made that film. One of the men he thought was his closest friend was an FBI informant. There were FBI informants working in the office there, destroying the files, and really they literally bankrupted the Matriciano. So the FBI can be used very effectively to target the president's enemies, but that's not what the FBI is for, not to act as a revenge arm for the federal government, and yet that's the reality of what happened, because the Matricianos were very close to me, and I was very close to them.
Yes,
so, and I'm sure you know that story. Well,
yes,
I do. As you go into the background of what's going to happen, do you think Hillary's going to be able to pull this off and get the Democrat nomination for the presidency?
Well, Dr. Stan, I honestly believe that she has such a huge campaign chest already built up and such access to so much money that she has such a large campaign staff already positioned around the country, that she has the enthusiastic backing of so many unions, teachers' unions, and lawyers, trial lawyers, special interest groups, gay and lesbian groups, and also, of course, she has this backing of her husband, and he's a very popular figure on the left wing of the party. That given all that, I think she is inevitably going to win, unless there's something that we can't predict that happens between now and 2008. that she will inevitably win the nomination of her party. The big question, of course, is can she win the White House? And I think that a lot of that depends on, number one, what's happening in the world, in the country. Number two, who is the Republicans find? At this point, they don't seem to have an obvious candidate. And three, whether Hillary can tip one or two critical red states into the blue column and garner enough electoral votes to win. I would not be surprised if she lost the popular vote and won the electoral vote.
Well, I hope you are not surprised, and that well, anyway, it's going to be very interesting to see what happens. But
I think that would be a disaster for our country. Right. I might add.
I do too. Well, I hope that your book will have an impact out there, and that more and more people will begin to understand. You have a notation on the back of the your book, and if I can just read from it, and it says she's the most unbelievable actress I've ever met, said a woman who's worked for Hillary's Senate campaign. I remember one time as a Women's Leadership Forum event in New York, 30 of us sat around Hillary talking about politics, and she said, you know, I love this organization, not just because we sit around and talk about politics, but because of the bonds of friendship forming around us. The way she said it, people were riveted by her performance, but I'd gotten to know her, and I could tell she didn't mean it. She had this unbelievable ability to be a liar. She is soulless. And that concept, she is soulless. In other words, she has no soul, no... that was a rather frightening statement.
But I think it's true. I think it's... that's why I put it there on the back of the dust jacket. Because I think it's very important in this day and age. You know, Ronald Reagan used the word evil to describe the Soviet Union. And I think, you know, he was roundly criticized for doing so because people don't use the word evil much anymore. But I think when it comes to Hillary Clinton, that word definitely applies. I think she is truly evil, and I think evil is something that we must not have in the Oval Office of the White House.
Well, of course, this is one of the recurrent themes of our program, is there really is evil in the world. A lot of people don't like to accept that, but I think it's true.
I do, too.
You comment she's a wife, but she shows no wifely instincts. She's a mother, but she isn't maternal. She's a feminist, but she rode to power on her husband's coattails. She's strong and assertive, but she has abetted decades of chronic infidelity. She inspires fierce loyalty among her followers, but she frequently stabs them in the back. And that would be one of the things that really is so disconcerting, is that apparently she has no true friends. All she has is, of course, her ambition, and she'll run roughshod over anybody to accomplish it.
Exactly, and this is the definition of an evil person, no question about it.
Well, what sort of response are you getting as you go around the country talking to various talk shows about Hillary? Because I know you're getting quite a bit of play. I know that Newsmax is booking you on a lot of programs, and they're doing a good job, incidentally.
So they are doing a wonderful job.
What sort of response are you getting from the audiences as you speak?
Well, Dr. Stan, I'm glad you asked that question because it gives me an opportunity to say how grateful I am to the conservative grassroots in this country who have responded so positively to this book. And it's the people in the conservative grassroots who have made this book the success that it is, and I couldn't be speaking to you even tonight if it weren't for the fact that there is decency in this country, there are morals in this country, there are people who care about values in this country, and these are the people who have helped make my book a success.
Well, you know, the thing is, the vast majority of people in America are good people. vast majority do have standard values. The vast majority of the people certainly believe in God, and they believe in right and wrong, and they're patriotic, and they love America, and they're very disconcerted about what's going on. That I think many of them really have almost this feeling of hopelessness. I mean, what can you do? It doesn't seem, no matter what happens, things go from bad to worse.
But we can spread the word, and that's what I've tried to do with The Truth About Hillary, spread the word about what she's, what is the truth, so that people can rally, share this book with each other, talk about it, and stop her before it's too late.
Amen to that. Well, we're going to just come back. We've only got 3 minutes before the program ends, or at least your segment of it. If you're out there in the listening audience, you'd like to talk to Mr. Klein, we will take one or two calls. Our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. The book, The Truth About Hillary, it's a great read. It's very well done. In fact, you get started in it, and you really don't want to put it down. We'll be back in just a moment here with a special guest this evening. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Mr. Ed Klein. His book, The Truth About Hillary, and of course it's a bestseller at the present time. It's getting a lot of coverage, and of course this story really begins with the story of Monica Lewinsky, which really, I think, epitomized what was going on as far as the Clinton presidency was concerned. But the most amazing thing to me about the book, and the point I thought Mr. Klein made so well, Ed made so well, was the fact that it was really Hillary that was responsible for getting, it was really Monica that got Hillary into the Senate race, and then, of course, to win in New York, because she was able to convince the American people that she was a wronged wife, and got this tremendous sense of sympathy from the American people. And then she began wearing these cute little pink dresses, and her hair looked so nice, and you know, she really did such a great job. And then why don't you pick up that, and then that wonderful picture of Bill and Hillary dancing at the beach after they finally had gotten back together. I mean, talk about the ultimate in hypocrisy.
Well, exactly. Hillary obviously wanted to send a strong visual message to the American public that she and Bill were really a loving couple, which of course they never had been. This was during the Lewinsky scandal. And so they went to an island in the Caribbean, and Hillary arranged for one single French photographer to be able to take a picture of them, she and Bill, as in their bathing suits they slow danced on the beach. Now, that was such an intimate moment, quote unquote, and yet there was a photographer there. And we know for a fact that it was all manipulation, because it was set up by Hillary.
And of course, as we often say here in our program, reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. And that's what it's all about. She's a master at perception, a master at knowing how to play the emotions of the American people. And of course, she's had a lot of help from the mass media, hasn't she?
Oh, she certainly has. The liberal mainstream media is so much in her pocket that it has almost become ludicrous to try to find an honest story about her in any of the mainstream media.
Well, I think that they won't find what you've written in your book. I want to thank you so much for being with us again, and we do have you for one more audience. Fortunately, we have three separate audiences during the week and one on the weekend, and we've got your schedule for about all of them. But thank you so very much for being our guest this evening, and thank you very much for writing the book, The Truth About Hillary.
Thank you, Dr. Stan.
Good night, Ed. Bye-bye.
Good night.
All right, fine. Well, I hope you've enjoyed our interview with Ed Klein. Very revealing. We didn't ask for questions because I wanted to hear what he had to say. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and if you want to understand the media, what's really going on, why, there is a book, it's entitled The New Media Monopoly. It's written by Professor Ben Bagdakian, who is a professor at University of Journalism at the University of California in Berkeley. He's a left-winger. I don't care whether he's left-winger or right-winger. It's a great book. I don't care what a man's political inclination is. because I don't think there's a great deal of difference between the left and the right, the conservatives, the liberals, two parts of the political spectrum. It is all created. It's all manipulated. But the book, The New Media Monopoly, goes into the fact that today five men dominate 95% of the American media, and Professor Bekdekian documents this. These media conglomerates control so many of the local newspapers and ultimately determine what the average American will read, what they will hear, what they will see, and ultimately what they will believe. That's the new media monopoly. Of course, we can recommend the books Mass Control and Mind Control. Both of those books were written by Jim Keith shortly before he met a very untimely end, a death, just before his publisher, the Illuminati Press, had a strange and untimely death. Shortly before his wife, then had his ex-wife, had a strange and untimely death. But the books Mass Control and Mind Control, we think, are very important to explain to you how they are able to control the reality of the American people. We have a great four-tape set on mind control, with interviews with people who've looked into the background of the various techniques that have been perfected here in the United States to manipulate and control what the American people think. And then, of course, we have a wonderful book, at least I think it's a wonderful book. It's called Operation Bluebird. It's written by Dr. Colin Ross, who is a psychiatrist, who deals with the victims of CIA mind control experiments. And yes, ladies and gentlemen, the CIA does use mind control experiments and has destroyed the minds of a certain number of people and created dissociative personalities. Fascinating look into that, and then a fascinating look into Operation Paperclip, when we brought the Nazis over here to continue their diabolical mind control experiments following World War II. And these are people, of course, who should have been tried at Nuremberg, but they were not. So Operation Bluebird is a fascinating book and gives you the background of so much of that. If you'd like to hear our interview with Dr. Colin Ross, that's in the four-tape set entitled Operation Paperclip. And there you'll hear Linda Hunt talking about the Operation Paperclip, bringing the Nazis to America, Dr. Colin Ross, talking about that, and then 2 hours on how the United States helped the Nazi war criminals to escape to South America. Did you ever wonder how Martin Bormann and Klaus Barbie and Adolf Eichmann and Dr. Mengele and 10,000 Nazis were able to escape, and why no one except a couple of the Jewish organizations were ever concerned, and only Barbie and Eichmann were ever captured and brought back? The rest lived out their lives comfortably in South America, along with a tremendous amount of gold that they had. And there was something called the Rat Line. And with the full help and support of first the OSS and then the Central Intelligence Agency, why we helped smuggle those Nazis out of Europe, and with the help of a certain subversive element within the Vatican, they got down there. We actually have a video, an ABC, I believe it was, of Sam Donaldson, who went down and actually talked to many of the Nazis. This was probably in the early 90s, and they were still alive and well and comfortable, living comfortably there, these mass murderers. But you see, when you understand there is an occult hierarchy that rules the world, that worked very closely with the Nazis, then you can begin to understand why these things happen. There really is, as Ed Klein said, there really is evil in the world. If you haven't seen our latest newsletter, The Occult Hierarchy Part 2, it's up on the internet at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com, or we'll be glad to send you a free copy. Our number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Just ask for the occult hierarchy. We'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. I've asked Steve Quayle to come on this evening to tell us about all of the biological scientists, the biologists who have met violent deaths in the last few years. And you must understand that the Central Intelligence Agency has been investigating and financing research in creating new diseases, horrible and terrible new diseases. And they began this back in 1953. They actually hired literally thousands of biological scientists to create new diseases. They were working on this in 1969 when Dr. MacArthur testified before the House Appropriations Committee and asked for $10 million to create a new disease for which there would be no immune response, a new form of mass killing. And he said some people think we shouldn't do this because it's a new form of mass killing, but we want to create this new disease anyway. And, well, everything would suggest that they did create it. It was called the acquired immune deficiency disease. But be that as it may, it's been strange that we've lost so many scientists recently. The last one I can remember was a few weeks ago when a very eminent, well-known, leading biologist, a biological scientist, was found murdered, multiple stab wounds, stuffed in the trunk of his car, which was burning. And Steve, of course, keeps track of this. He knows more about this than anybody else in the country, and that's why I want to introduce Steve Quayle. Steve, thanks so very much for being with us.
Well, Dr. Stan, again, it's a delight. And, you know, this is the key story that has been going on under the radar of mainstream press. We're talking about the foremost. We're not talking about first-year or second-year biology students. We're talking about the foremost biological microbiologists in the world being systematically liquidated, murdered. The tie they all have together, and we'll hit this right in the top of your show, is they were all involved in bioweapons research. They all were linked to each other, especially when they were dealing with issues of immunity, molecular biology, especially some of the guys like Dr. David Kelly, who is the head of British intelligence's entire biological weapons development program. He's the gentleman, if you remember, Dr. Stan, that they had so many different stories about how he died, that he supposedly committed suicide, yet he was found in a park. His body was repositioned numerous times, and obviously the investigation that took place into Dr. David Kelly, the head of Porton Down, British's Ministry of Defense Biological and Chemical Weapons Development, they can't tell the truth. There is no truth in this world that will even begin to, be dealt with by the mainstream press. And these are huge stories. The latest death happened just a couple days ago, and this is kind of what I think that is very telling and compelling to the world. One of Russia's foremost scientists. Now, Russia's got a history concurrent with the United States of anybody that worked in any of the secret labs that really knew what was going on seems to be systematically liquidated. The latest one, number 78 on my list, who died June 8, 2005, was a gentleman who is called Leonid Strashunsky. And Strashunsky died after supposedly being hit on the head with a champagne bottle. But his specialty was creating microbes that were resistant to biological weapons. And again, typical story, Dr. Stan. He's found dead in a hotel room in Moscow where he was en route to the United States. And here's the funny part of this story. Investigators are looking for a connection between the murder of this leading bioweapons research guy and they had a hepatitis outbreak in a place called Tver, Russia, which I think has got to about 400 people infected. So,
that's all right there. All right, well, we've got Steve Quayle with us, and we're talking about, of course, the strange death of so many people who are in biological warfare research. And what are we up to, about 80, Steve?
Yep, we're right at 78 to 80. And, you know, the one that you were talking about, Robert J. Lowell, age 66, died May 19, 2005, multiple stab wounds, you know, his missing car and credit card theft. Homicide inspector are claimed that they weren't the motives. And, again, this is kind of interesting because all of these guys are absolute, you know, heads and tails above the rest of their colleagues. You know, one of the criticisms levied at me continually is, oh, there's nothing unusual about in the space of 3 years, 100 or 78 to 80, 100, some people claim it's closer to 100, prominent microbiologists being murdered, having strange accidents. And, you know, Dr. Stan, again, you just opened the intro with acquired immune deficiency, and we all know the history, thanks to your incredible efforts, of explaining to the people. I think you better tell the people right off the top. I know you've iterated this so many times, but there is a group of individuals that absolutely want 4/5 to 90% of the world's population destroyed. And when you're dealing with nuclear weapons, the point that nuclear weapons have, they have secondary results that they don't want to deal with. So who could ever devise and who can come up with the ultimate biological killing machine, having the vaccine in their back pocket, can literally decide who lives and who dies? And I think that's what we're dealing with. We're dealing with the systematic production of biological pathogens which can be released on the earth and basically take their toll. You know, there was a time when Ebola, hemorrhagic fever, CCHF, Crimean Congo hemorrhagic fever, all of the hemorrhagic fevers had about a 20 to 30% mortality rate. Now, Dr. Stan, they're up to 100. And, you know, as a physician, that doesn't happen in nature unless somebody's helping it to happen.
And I think it's so important that people understand that these aren't new diseases. You know, before about 1967, nobody had ever heard of these diseases. And the first cases occurred in a place called Marburg, Germany. And they were in laboratory monkeys that were going to be a sacrifice so they could use their kidneys to grow the polio vaccine. And had the monkeys not started dying, they would have made a vaccine that would have killed all of Africa. But of course, the initial infection rate was only 30, death rate was only 30 or 40%. But, you know, as time goes by, all sorts of new versions of this disease pop up. Where do they come from? They find them in the Sudan. They find them in southern Africa. Now they're in western Africa. How did they get there? Where are they in the between time? And why is it becoming increasingly, increasingly lethal? Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Steve Quayle, and we're talking about the fact that there are all these new diseases. And Steve had mentioned the fact that the Marburg disease and Ebola certainly are becoming increasingly lethal. And initially they were 30, 40% lethal. Now they're 90% lethal. Why have they changed? Well, of course, it's Steve's contention, and it's my as well, that these are man-made diseases. They know how to create new diseases. They know how to create race-specific diseases. They know how to create diseases that will kill almost everyone on the face of the earth. And, of course, they know how to stop the epidemics, too. But right now, I think that they're trying to scare us to death, and they're going to come up with some vaccines, and, oh, you've got to take that vaccine to protect yourself. We're from the government. Just roll up your sleeve, and heaven help us, because I don't trust them. I think they're going to put something in these vaccines that will make, of course, the epidemics of Marburg and Ebola pale into insignificance. Is anybody that evil? Yes, there really are. And if you haven't yet read those remarks of Jacques Cousteau, and would be glad to send you copies of his publication, or the publication where he's quoted, called The UNESCO Courier, November of 1991, where Jacques Cousteau calls for the elimination of 350,000 people a day. 350,000 people a day. How could anybody really even consider that? Well, when you're dealing with evil people like we are, why, it's very easy to understand. You pick up the story there, Steve.
Well, again, you know, what most people cannot understand or imagine is that there is, and this is my opinion, I know you share it, but these willing cohorts with the powers of darkness, they have no love for humanity. They basically are in the helping the powers of darkness destroy humanity. And again, given the amount of money that's been in the black ops programs, And given the amount of a higher form of killing, there was a fabulous book by that name. I don't know if you ever read that, Stan.
No, I never did.
I forget the author right now. The title is A Higher Form of Killing, but it basically details all of the money that's been spent in biological and chemical warfare. You know, I broke the story a number of years ago. Prior to anybody even dealing with weapons of mass destruction, I was on a national talk radio show, and I made the statement that it was my contention within a matter of weeks we would see the first usage of either a chemical or biological weapon. Well, that happened to be prior to the Aum Shinrikyo release of sarin gas in the Tokyo subway. What I have done, and so I can tell people what the sources of information, I went about to interview different people after the breakup of the Soviet Union. You could pretty much buy anything you wanted in the way of military technology, military parts, scientific technology. You could buy pathogens, nuclear, anything you wanted. Let's just say this. Anything and everything was available. And so what I began to do is interview these different people to find out where the bioweapon scientists were going, because Russia had an extensive program of combining Ebola and smallpox and came up with basically a cocktail called Ebola Pox, but also they came up with a substance called A231 and 232, which was called Novichok, and Novichok meant newcomer, and the lethality of this stuff was absolutely astronomical. In other words, sarin, tabun, all of the prior chemical weapons were exceeded in a kill ratio by literally 10,000 to 1. So I started investigating this stuff, and that's when I wrote my book a number of years ago. You interviewed me a number of years ago, Breathe No Evil.
Right.
And as you remember, I mean, the problem I had is no mainstream publishers. They said, well, what's that? Nobody cares about that. And I said to one of them, I said, this will become the biggest story after the turn of the century. This was obviously before the year 2000. And I said, and furthermore, when the genetic ramifications of this scientific endeavor, and, you know, that's probably undertaking is a better word, and undertaking meaning for the world's population. The point being is that it would be horrendous in the ramifications, and now we're seeing everything from genetically modified foods, and by the way, all this stuff ties together. When these scientists, getting back, these scientists who are murdered, they're murdered for not only what they know, they're murdered for not only who they knew, but they're also murdered because these are the preeminent epidemiologists. These are preeminent molecular biologists, Dr. Don Wiley, etc. And we'll get to him in a minute. But, you know, the point that I've got to share with people is these are guys that could find out not only what the pathogen was, you know, consisted of, but these would be the guys that we would turn to basically help us in our fight against a total biological weapons attack. Now we're dealing with everything from, as you know, SARS to bird flu. We've had, you know, the whole issue. You said they're trying to scare people. Absolutely. Fear produces basic control, so the mechanism is out there. And I, for one, nothing that they would give me would or tell me would provoke me to get any vaccines. You know, it's like the whole thing with our servicemen. So many of America's best and brightest are suffering horrible, unimaginable symptoms and diseases because of unproven vaccines given for biological weapons. And you know, and you and I have talked about it in the past, that anthrax vaccines that were not proven, anthrax vaccines that were, quote, beyond experimental, and even in the cases where they had safer vaccines, they would still use the experimental vaccines. And the rest is history. So, you know, when people tell me, well, our government would never do that, the bottom line is you can go on numerous searches on the Internet and find out all the experimentation that's been done on the American public.
And certainly all we have to do is remember what happened to Tuskegee. We carry the Rockefeller Committee report put out by the Veterans Administration talking about the hundreds of thousands of Americans that they'd done experiments on, the plutonium studies where they were feeding the kids in the orphanages plutonium and giving people shots, and of course we know what they did with MK Ultra, where they were giving people LSD and at least one of them committed suicide. Oh, they were experimenting on people. The stories of this journey into madness, the story of some of their psychological experiments on people, Colin Ross's book, Operation Blueberg, all the people that they've created multiple personalities in and destroyed their lives, the CIA playing these little games with people just to see what would happen. Should we be surprised that they would resort to mass murder of the scientists who could expose what's going on? If you know too much, why, of course, your life is in danger. And I think that Steve has done a tremendous job cataloging all of this. And he has, of course, it's all up on your website, isn't it, Steve?
Yeah. People that want to see this can go to my website and the Dead Scientist link. And unfortunately, it's being updated. And, you know, Dr. Stan, one of the things that becomes obvious, too, is that in some months, you know, these guys are dying within many cases, weeks of each other. And what's interesting is one of the most famous deaths that is astonishing to me is Dr. David Wynn Williams. He died at the age 55 back in March of 2002. But what was fascinating is he is probably, at the time of his death, was the foremost astrobiologist with the Antarctic Astrobiology Project at NASA's Ames Research Center. And what he was doing was he was dealing in the Antarctic with some of the bacteria and pathogens and some of the interesting flora and fauna that's been sealed under the ice in Antarctica in what's called Lake Vostok. Now, both the Russians, the United States, everybody has a desire to get access to these microbes because they're primordial. Some of them, they claim, go back millions of years. I'm not going to argue the time of the bacteria. I'm just telling you that I found it interesting that a man that of his caliber dies in March 2004. Then a day later, Dr. Stephen Mostow, and he was one of the most famous infectious disease and bioterrorism experts in the country, Dean of University of Colorado Health Science, he died in a plane crash near Centennial Airport. And he was known as Dr. Flu for his expertise in treating influenza. And now what are we dealing with? We're dealing with the global pandemic threat of avian influenza. You know, we're dealing with all of the stuff. And isn't it amazing, Dr. Stan, that, again, these guys die within a day of each other? And somebody says, well, that's coincidence. And I can tell you this. I've had a statistician do the work on this. I'm not capable of, let's just say this, my math skills wouldn't take me into the field of statistical analysis. But the point I'm trying to make is that when, you know, he ran a chart for me, and I'm going to put that chart up as soon as I find it, but the point is that it showed the statistical probabilities of two of these people, and he set the criteria. This guy's got a PhD in statistical analysis, and basically the statistical probability of the who's who dying in this short of time in the manner they died was basically statistically improbable. He even found patterns within it. And he said, I can tell you this, he said, this is so contrived that basically anybody with any understanding of statistical analysis and how the application of statistical analysis to a given field of individuals, they said they would have to come to the conclusion that you've been talking about, Steve. And again, you know, look, that's what somebody who's bright says, but I think common sense tells us that, you know, when you and I talked a number of years ago, I'll put your memory to be refreshed a little bit. Remember we were talking about the people out digging up the Spanish flu victims of 1918?
Right.
You know, and you and I were both basically incredulous on the radio, not with each other, but with that thought, that here you had a global pandemic, a pathogen that was taken out of frozen bodies, recultured, and then, if that wasn't good enough, they were messing with it to tweak it to make it even more effective. And again, you know, that kind of was released in mainstream news for a little while, and the scientists' thought behind it is, well, we need to dig these guys up and, you know, reconstitute it just in case we're ever hit with it again. And no one simply asked them, well, aren't you guys almost building the case for it escaping? And you and I have talked also, Dr. Stan, about the situation with all of the microbes that you can buy on the open market just through normal lab supply outfits. It's tragic. It's a tragedy that most people can't even get their minds around.
Well, I think that, Steve, the biggest problem we have is a matter of perception. Yep. It is so evil that people find it difficult to believe that anything like this could happen. I mean, they know what happened in the Holocaust, but, well, of course, we never do mention that only about a third of the people killed were Jews. There were twice as many Christians that were killed, but we never talk about that. We never talk about the 41 to 43 to 46 million people the Chinese communists starved to death between 1958 and 1962. How could you conceal something like that? Why, you control the media. You control what people think. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I was just talking about the Great Famine. Anybody would like to get the details on that, it'll be covered in our latest newsletter, or we'd be glad to send them copies of the page out of Stephen Mosier's book. Stephen, of course, knew many of the people over there in China, and the figures for the Great Famine between 1958 and 1962 in China, according to the Chinese Communist Party, were between 43 and 46 million people were starved to death over a four-year period. How could you conceal something of that magnitude? Why, you control the media in America, and then you control people's perception. That they would intentionally murder that many of their own people seems incredible, and yet, of course, when you realize that we're up against organized evil, why, of course, all really begins to make sense. But I think that this is something that is even more concerned what Steve is talking about, because we are being besieged almost on a daily basis with an article in one of the newspapers I read, and I read, oh, it's probably six or eight a day. And, of course, we're talking about the threat of the avian flu virus. Now, there have been very, very few cases that have been passed on to human beings, but apparently there is this very, very lethal molecule, this gene that we found in the Spanish flu called H5N1, something like that gene that makes this very, very lethal. Of course, it's very, very lethal for the birds. But what would happen, they keep saying, what would happen if that suddenly was able to break out into the general population? Now, they do not put these articles in day after day, week after week, month after month. Newspaper articles, television production and articles, radio commentary on this, unless they're planning on doing something. I think that they're preparing us for a major world influenza. I think they know exactly what they're doing. I think we're dealing with very, very evil people who would like to kill off a large part of the world's population. They really only want to leave the number that they need to serve them. Could this really be what's his plan? Well, I suggest you read some of the writings of Bertrand Russell, of Jacques Cousteau, or go to our website of RadioLiberty.com, pull down our article on the Population Control Agenda monograph, and read the quotations from Mr. Pimentel and from the various people at the Gorbachev conference, and go, of course, to Elberton, Georgia, and see the Georgia Guidestones, and read what David Foreman has said, and read what Pinch Philip has said. He wants to come back as a virus so he can kill people. There really are people that have a different sense of values than logical people. But they're, if you understand they're people with a different worldview who have no human compassion, then, of course, the idea that they would create massive epidemics to kill millions of people are not that unlikely. And my concern is that Steve is absolutely right, that these people know too much, and of course that they will be eliminated, because the last thing the people on the other side want is for the people to catch even a glimpse of what lies in store for mankind in the years that lie ahead. So pick up the story there, Steve.
Well, I think that, again, you've laid it out so well, but now I think they're changing their tune a little bit, where they used to use cloak of darkness, they used to be what were called shadow scientists. Now, with the emphasis on all of the transgenic, if you will, laboratory experiments going on, not a day goes by that some new barrier hasn't been breached, some new revelation hasn't come forward. And you know, Dr. Stan, this is astonishing to me, because again, in my newest book that I wrote called Genetic Armageddon, I don't think people understand. You know, when God created everything, he saw...
Hold that thought for just a minute, Steve, when we bring our stations back on. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Steve Quayle, and he's written a new book. I haven't read it yet, but I'm going to have to get a copy of it. It's called Genetic Armageddon. Pick up the story there, Steve.
Well, Genetic Armageddon basically details what's called the transhumanist movement. And, you know, when you're dealing with biological pathogens, when you're dealing with the destruction of humanity as we know it, as God created it, I said before we went into the break or the coming back on the air that God saw everything in Genesis that it was good, and he set specific barriers for everything. The word transgenic, as you know, means crossing genetic barriers or cross species. So now we have the human-animal manipulation of the gene structures. We're hearing about all these marvelous things on the horizon that are going to help solve all the diseases. They've isolated, as you know, the Methuselah gene. That's what they call it. But what people don't understand is there is a true undercurrent of something that would make Shelley's Frankenstein seem like a daily cartoon show. When the Frankenstein novel came out, it took the world that could read by storm. But what's going on right now, the transhumanism means that under the guise of building a better man, the transhumanists believe that they can breed out or genetically alter out all of man's weaknesses and produce the Superman that Hitler looked for, or the Ubermensch, as Nietzsche talked about it. So what we've got, Dr. Stan, interestingly enough, we've got the same scientific thought pattern and mind forms forming right now in the United States of America that were present in Nazi Germany. And it's nothing new. You know, I mean, I tell people all the time, the British Museum is on open statement on the record as saying the day will come when they're going to clone Rameses II because they have viable DNA from him. And without getting into all that, suffice it to say that in the last couple days we've heard that woolly mammoths that have been extinct are going to be reconstituted. So I call it Jurassic madness. Michael Crichton wrote the book Jurassic Park, and I just got to give him kudos. Well, what foresight did he have to see that? So it's not enough now to bring back, Tyrannosaurus Rex or Diplodocus or even Ramses II. Now we have to basically make a better human. We have to make something that transcends humanity. And I can tell you this, Dr. Stan, that the book, I quote, the leading scientific minds, and I will get one to you tomorrow. I will FedEx it for Monday. But the point that I'm trying to make in this is that most people can't even imagine how, you know, outside of biology students, how all this stuff works. But what they should be able to see is that when the Australians announced several years back that they had come up with the ultimate doomsday weapon, mousepox, do you remember that story?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, when they announced that, and within about 24 hours, somebody began to announce that they were working on mousepox, the ultimate doomsday weapon, and combining it with the Spanish flu of 1918. I can only say this, the word insanity, there are no words in a normal vocabulary that can even begin to describe what, and I say this, a supernatural or a preternatural, meaning above the natural insanity that's present.
Well, I think anybody who has studied the SARS epidemic, which we had about a year ago, will remember that the first case occurred in a professor. He was a professor of biology. He was a professor of working on biological warfare agents. He was from a Chinese university. He was the first person to come down with it. Is it possible that he was working on that in his laboratory, and then this is how it spread out into the general community? People don't like to think about this, but these things really do happen. And now, of course, we know that they're working in laboratories throughout the world, and they have the genetic makeup of the Spanish flu virus, the part that made it so lethal. Why would they dig that up and begin experimenting with that, and even talking about perhaps putting that onto an influenza, some sort of a very, very highly contagious influenza virus? If you understand, there are really people out there who would like to kill off most of the world's population. Everything makes sense. But if you're looking for anything logical, you're not going to find it. I mean, all you need to do is see what they're doing with the genetic engineering of food, and, of course, how they are releasing these products with actually very little animal experiments. And when you look at the animal experiments, they're frightening. And, of course, we have to talk about not what happens in over a period of a month in animal experience. What's going to happen to humans in a lifetime when they're eating these genetically modified foods? You would think that they would try them for with a limited population for 10 years or 5 years, but they're not doing that. And they're covering up the very, very dangerous results that they have. And if you haven't gone into the BT corn now, that is about 50 to 60% of our corn. And you can go up on the Internet and pull down the analysis of Monsanto's study. Well, part of the study, they won't show us most of it, but it affects the kidneys, it affects the blood cells, it affects the triglycerides, and that's in what they release and from the animal studies. What else does it do? They're not telling us why. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Steve Quayle. Of course, we're talking about the material that he has put together, the analysis that he has put together dealing with all the scientists who have passed away. And as soon as we get back, all of our stations get back with us, Steve, I want you to get your telephone number out and your website so that our listeners can go there and perhaps they'd like to get your new book on genetic Armageddon. Because you hate to sound like an alarmist, but somebody's got to sound the alarm, and I think you're doing a great job of it, and I really appreciate your keeping all those records and keeping a tally of what's going on. Have you been criticized for doing this sort of thing?
Oh, absolutely, and, you know, again, what I don't mind valid criticism, but what I really mind is what I call moronic, ignorant criticism. For instance, let me give you a good example. Today's the 16th of June, and 1 year ago today, we had kind of coming up on July 2nd, excuse me, listen to these two and tell me how these guys can die, a matter of 2 to 3 days apart. Dr. Larry Bustard, age 53, died July 2nd, 2004 from unknown causes. Now listen to this, Dr. Stan. He was a Sandia scientist in the Department of Energy who helped develop a foam spray to clean up congressional buildings and media sites during the anthrax scare. He worked at Sandia National Labs in Albuquerque and was an expert on bioterrorism, and his team was the one that came up with a new technology used against biological and chemical agents. Now, that was on July 2nd, 2004. Now, get this one. Professor Stephen Tabet, T-A-B-E-T, or Tabe, age 42, died on July 6, 2004 from an unknown illness. He was an associate professor and epidemiologist at the University of Washington, a world-renowned HIV doctor and researcher who worked on HIV and was in a clinical trial of a group of vaccines in the HIV Vaccine Trial Network. Now, again, when people say from an unknown illness, that's like basically Pandora's box, because what we know exists is nothing compared to what exists in the world of black science. By the definition of black science, I mean secret and ultra top secret, above top secret science. And again, when you have Professor Stephen Tabet dying and Dr. Larry Bustard within 4 days of each other, actually I think I did the math on it, was within 72 hours of each other, it becomes a little unsettling. Because again, the thing that's amazing to everybody is that you've got these guys who are not flunky scientists. That's the other criticism I always get. Oh, you know, in any group of population, you're going to have this many people die of natural causes. You know what's amazing?
Hold that thought as we bring our other stations right back on board here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Steve Quayle. And Steve is simply pointing out that there was two scientists who died within about 4 days of one another just a year ago. And these were top-notch scientists involved with biological warfare research. And the chances of this happening just by chance is beyond comprehension. But when you're getting up around 80 of them having died in the last 3 or 4 years, you know very well that somebody is eliminating these people because they know too much. Well, could you imagine the implications if the American people knew that they were working with diseases to kill off a large part of the world's population? If that sounds incredible, let me tell you that there's a wonderful book. It's a fictional book. It's called Rainbow Six, written by Tom Clancy. But in the foreword of the book, he says this book contains information that the government doesn't want you to know about. And it's all about massive genocide and massive population control involving people at the highest levels of our government and their plan for worldwide genocide. It's an incredible book because, of course, I think that Tom Clancy has access to information that would, of course, pale most of what I've been able to glean. I know that Steve's right on the front line of this. Do you know that book at all, Steve?
Yeah, I'm familiar with it. I haven't read the whole thing, but I'm familiar with the premise, and Tom Clancy's, is incredibly connected. What an incredible talent, too.
Right.
I mean, just brilliant. But again, what he has done through his books is lift the veil, in my opinion, on what really goes on behind the scenes. You can say things in a novel format, as you know, Dr. Stan, that you can't say and get away with in a regular format. And I think Tom Clancy's done a fabulous job and continues to do a fabulous job. And what we're talking about tonight, look, we're not making this stuff up. These men were who they were. You know, we talked about Dr. Larry Buster dying for the stations that have just joined us, July 2004, from unknown causes, Sandia scientists. By the way, when I ran the age, the average age of these guys is somewhere between 48 and 52, so you can't claim that they're, you know, 70-year-old or 80-year-old men who are facing eternity. But we were just talking about Dr. Stephen Tabbitt, who was one of the world-renowned, okay, HIV doctors and researchers. Then about, let's see, what is it, two weeks later, almost to the day, we had Dr. John Badway, cited as an accidental politician when he was a biochemist at Harvard Medical School specializing in infectious diseases. So again, the who's who of the world, are being systematically, and I say this, liquidated. Let's go to John Montaigne, because he died November 2nd of 2004. And I try and put real faces with these people when we can find pictures of them, because I think it's so incredibly, let me say this, this is my opinion, and not Dr. Stan's necessarily, I speak only for myself, but this is the most cynically and insane news reporting group in the world. The United States Press, the United States News, television, these guys don't touch this stuff. Dr. Montaigne, okay, he's the guy that died in Mexico, no cause stated, supposedly had a pulmonary embolism, excuse me, I can't say that word tonight, but he was a PhD, head of U.S. Infectious Diseases unit under Tommy Thompson. And so here you have Tommy Thompson's head, and the guy gets whacked mysteriously, you know, in Mexico. And you never see, what also, you know, Dr. Stan, the excuses given, what you come up with when you look at the investigative techniques of this stuff, when you begin to look into this, it's always, I mean, this is true, it is a total cover-up. You've got the Don C. Wiley, who ends up having his car found on the Hernando de Soto Bridge, and the day that he disappeared, I said he's been murdered, okay? Everybody said, oh, I'm an alarmist, I'm a, trying to make people scared, blah, blah, blah. And I said, you mark my words, he will be found to have been murdered. Well, then, interestingly enough, the medical examiner who ruled on his case is found almost a year later, tied up with barbed wire, I don't know if you remember this story, with a bomb strapped to his chest. Now, what did O.C. Smith work on that would get him put into that position? And then the government comes after O.C. Smith, who's the forensic examiner of Don Wiley, and others, and basically tries to build a case that says this. You ready for this? He tied himself up with barbed wire and put the bomb on his own chest.
Right. Like the fellow who committed suicide by shooting him in the chest 5 times with a rifle.
You got it.
Right. That was a fellow who was going to turn the tables, are going to bring out, expose Lyndon Johnson. Well, anyway, I want you to get your telephone number and your website out so people can go there. And then we're going to go to Bart, who's calling from Carmel. But how can people get in touch with you? How can they get your information?
Well, first of all, the information that we're talking about with all the backup documentation is on my website, www.steve, all one word, lowercase, QUAYLE.com. STEVEQUAYLE.com. Go to the, when you go to my website, you'll see a big Q. Click on the Q, it'll take you to the main page, and it's towards the top of the page where it says Chronology of Dead Scientists. There are literally hundreds of backup documents, and to my knowledge, it's the biggest site of its kind in the world documenting this stuff. And I can tell you, Dr. Stan, you may find this interesting, your listeners will definitely find this interesting. You know who hits that site more than anybody in the whole world? The powers that be in Washington. I mean, it's amazing. Through my computer, we can obviously see who's looking at what. It's amazing. It's like a who's who in the defense. And so people are aware of this, okay? But again, I don't think they recognize that it's their grandchildren. And if the same people that would, you know, put our own servicemen in harm's way by giving them untested vaccines, these guys probably aren't going to care about service guy or his family or their children or the grandchildren, if they should be so blessed to be able to have that. So again, what this is to me is the quintessential smoking gun leading up to the fact that a pandemic is being planned. Every single avenue that could react to the pandemic, that could act or react, is being systematically closed or eliminated. The multiple suicides, quote unquote, the strange situations, these are the most bizarre deaths. These aren't just, oh, by the way, they shoot themselves five times in the head, you know, with a rifle that only has a, you know, a three-round magazine. The point is that these are the systematic assassinations of the foremost biologists. And again, before people take my assertions on, I would encourage them, I won't argue with them until they've read the backup documentation, because I go to some of their theses. I mean, I do my homework, and these guys, by contemporary accolades and by the papers they've written, you can't get any more prominent men, Dr. Stan. You can't. They don't exist. These guys are being liquidated.
Well, let's get your telephone number out so if people want to buy your book.
Sure. They can get my book, by the way, on the Internet, too. If they want to order online, they can go to the Internet and click on the nav bar that says order books. But if they want to call and order the book, it's 406-586-4840.
One more time.
406-586-4840.
All right, and let's go to Bart, who's been patiently waiting on the line here. Hi, Bart. How are you doing?
Fine, sir. Thank you. Steve, my question goes directly to the statement that you just made about pandemics. I said to somebody the other day, I said, do you remember how in the year 2000, Y2K was on everybody's lips? Y2K this, Y2K that, Y2K, Y2K, Y2K. I said, well, here's the story. A year from now, the acronym that's going to be on everybody's lips in the same type of phenomenon as we had with Y2K will be this, H5N1.
H5N1, the molecule there that is so lethal.
Yes, what do you think about that assessment, Steve?
Well, first of all, I absolutely agree with your assessment, and I agree, and forgive me, but I wrote about it in 1996, okay, and dealt with it back then, so, you know, almost 9 years down the line, I feel, and I don't mean to sound sarcastic in any way, so don't take it that way, but to me, what's old hat has just become common knowledge in the United States, and I think that the word pandemic, look, if they tell you that there's a pandemic, or they tell us, and they make us fearful, then they provide the solution. It's a Hegelian dialectic, New World Order style, and everybody runs to get the vaccine. They've accomplished the same thing, even if they're not ready or actually have made the quantum leap to release it. So, you know, I believe that they have generated every pathogen that they're now telling us to be worried about. I believe by frightening us into the vaccine, and by the way, they've covered that, as you know, in the Model Emergency Health Powers Act, which is called MEPA, where basically anybody that won't take the vaccines could be quarantined, they could be moved into containment centers, and so I think aren't you pretty much saying the same thing as I am?
Yes, sir, I am, and the one factor that adds credibility...
Bart, do you mind hanging on? We got somebody calling from Norway. I'm going to put you on hold.
Okay.
Okay, let's go to Leif, who's calling from Norway, and then we'll get back to Bart. Hi, Leif, how are you doing?
Well, okay, hello. Thank you, I'm doing fine. You don't really have to put the other one on hold. I can wait.
All right, well, go ahead. Go ahead, and we'll get back to Bart in just a minute.
Okay.
Leif is calling over from Norway. So is anybody over there in Norway even aware of the things that Steve is talking about? I would not have Steve on if I did not have complete confidence that his material is valid and that every American needs to know it. And everybody in Norway needs to know it, too. But it sounds so incredible, most people are going to say, that couldn't be true.
I have some friends, and some people are aware of it, yes. I called, there was a recent outbreak of a bacteria in Norway, and 10 people died. I think it was late May or beginning of this month. And the bacteria is named Legionella pneumophila, something like that.
Is that a Legionella?
Yeah, Legionella.
Okay. Right, that's Legionnaires' disease, which is a relatively new disease, too. It's been around maybe for 20, 30 years now. Right.
Yes. So I wanted to ask, because it was discovered in 1977, I saw on the Internet.
Right.
Your guest mentioned something about CIA, and are there any evidences that this particular bacteria have been developed by men?
Do you have any thoughts on that, Steve?
I do, and I think that was Dr. Stanton brought up the CIA. I maintain it's beyond the CIA. I believe it's a global group of individuals that have basically sat down and played Monopoly. But let's talk about Legionnaire's disease, and let's also talk about the Norwalk virus. So many cruise ships, Steve, have come down with Norwalk virus over the last year. I detail them in my book, Genetic Armageddon, but I also have them on the Internet, so you can go to my website and look at all this stuff. But what cruise ships afford the bioweapons designer to all the listening audience is it affords them a portable floating laboratory that if something gets out of hand, you can basically contain, and that means destroy. Whenever you hear the word containment, Norwalk virus that has broken out on multiple cruise ships, and I think at one point in 2003 or 4, combined there were over 48 cruise ships that had an outbreak of Norwalk. So there are similarities between Norwalk and Legionnaire in that obviously food becomes a vector in both of them. But what I'm saying is my opinion that, and you must understand this, under a bioweapons development program, every single pathogen is looked at, experimented on, and attenuated. And so I believe that, I can't say that Norway was, but I believe that Norwalk virus on the cruise ships was definitely a test of the different strains of viruses. Because, you know, Dr. Stan and Leaf, whenever you hear the word like after a statement, a Norwalk-like virus, an Ebola-like virus, that word like is the key and the most flashing warning signal that you can get. What that means is it differs from the initial strain so much that the only thing they can take it to is the underlying strain. And so in that, I would say that, anytime you see outbreaks that are, quote, Legionnaire-like or Norwalk-like, that's your giveaway.
Well, that's
a telltale sign. I don't mean to use slang. That is the evidence that something other than just the main pathogen is in effect.
And Leif, the first outbreak of a Legionnaire's disease occurred at a convention of the American Legion in a hotel, and all the people came down ill. What a wonderful group to experiment on. There really are evil people who will do this sort of thing.
That, right. Yeah. Have I answered your question, Leif?
Yes. I said the thing wrong. I said CIA, but I do indeed know that it's the world group of elitists.
And again, the thing that I don't think people understand, and this is something too, when we're talking about a global pandemic, the global pandemic now can be key to any specific genetically identifiable group. I don't know if most people can grasp the effect of that statement, Dr. Stan, but for instance, every single group in the world, no matter what nationality, no matter what blood type, all those things, the specific genotype and the specific blood chemistry, you have now the effective ability. Dr. Wouter Bassan of South Africa was one of the guys that worked on this the most to develop it. He was tried in South Africa and finally acquitted. But the point is that technology and that knowledge went all over the world. So if you see an outbreak, for instance, let me just make this a real practical and historical. If you see an outbreak on the Pakistan border, Pakistan-Afghanistan border, and you've got an outbreak of what's called Crimean-Congo hemorrhagic fever, and the only people it attacked were relatives and tribesmen related genetically to a specific group, and no one else came into contact with it, I made the statement one night on Coast to Coast, Dr. Stan, and Jane's Defense Weekly carried the news on their website, and 2 million people hit their website in a matter of 5 minutes. And so the point that I'm trying to make in all this is that when you start to see that there are indigenous groups of people that are used as, and please, I'm not saying they are, but they're treated by contempt for those who hate humanity as the ultimate guinea pigs, that's the other thing I look for all the time. Is there a specific or a defined outbreak in a tribal region? And that's what we've just experienced in the Congo, and also that we've experienced in Angola.
And, of course, in the United States, 65% of the new AIDS cases just happen to be in blacks, just by coincidence. This disease is designed, in my estimation, to attack blacks. This is why it's decimating Africa and the general population, why it hasn't broken out in the white population. There really are people who hate blacks. Hey, Leif, we got to let you go.
Yes.
Bye-bye.
Thank
Thanks so much. Thanks. And let's go quickly to Bart. What else do you want to say, Bart, before I have to let you go?
Real quickly, Dr. Bill Deagle is sending out a red alert on the H5N1 saying it is coming. Get ready.
Okay. Thanks so much. And let's go to Tim, who's calling from Indiana. Hi, Tim. How are you doing?
Oh, hi, Dr. Stan. Dr. Ron Valdeseri, he's with the Center for Disease Control. He says that there's 40,000 new cases of HIV every year, and that among blacks, it's 10 times higher among blacks than whites.
Gee, I wonder why. Could it be that this is genetically specific for them? And the answer is yes. Hey,
and
hang on.
Okay, go ahead. I had a question.
Go ahead.
For Steve, should I wait or?
Hold on.
Okay.
Okay, this is Dr. Stan, I guess, Steve Quayle, and we've got Tim from Indiana. Go ahead, Tim. You can ask your question now.
Okay. Real quick here, Stephen. It was reported earlier in the week around Sunday night, I think, or Monday on CNN, that there's possibly another mad cow. You mean we only have two mad cows in the whole country? And
But they're in Washington.
We'll have to wait 2 weeks, though, for the results, because we have to send a sample to England? Don't we have labs here?
Well, absolutely. I mean, let me tell you the history of mad cow disease, and I think we'll put it into perspective. A group of cannibals, literally in New Guinea, had a form of encephalitis outbreak years ago in the early 60s, which was, they called it kuru, okay? We sent our scientists down there to basically culture it out, because we were developing biological weapons back in the 60s, contrary to what most people know or think. Same thing with bovine spongiform encephalopathy, the chronic wasting disease in animals. Of course we can do it, but you got to understand that, you know this, of course, but everyone must understand that what is expedient financially for the country takes precedent versus what is truthful and life-saving for its population and taxpayers. So I think it's a total fallacy. I used to talk extensively about BSE because, to me, it was the closest link to the bioweapons labs of anything that we've heard. I live in Montana, and we've got chronic wasting disease. We've got the trout up here have a form of it called whirling disease. Our deer and elk and buffalo are, being exposed to it. And basically, I don't think people understand this, Dr. Stan, that when Dr. Prusner defined what the prions or prions, I pronounce prions, some people pronounce it prions, that when you do a necropsy, is that the correct word?
An autopsy.
Yeah, necropsy on the brain. You know, the point is that you can't autoclave the stuff. So why labs don't like to do BSE is because it requires the complete destruction of the lab lab equipment that did it. That's what I'm being told. But I think it's horse manure, and I'm sorry, that's what it is, and I think that the wrong end of the horse is believing the horse manure.
Well, one quick question now. Is this part of the mind conditioning to accept the global dependency where we have to depend on France for our vaccines and England to test for viruses? Thank you.
I'll tell you, I think it's even more sinister than that. Dr. Stan just went into detail on genetically modified food. What happens if everything that's natural becomes no good for us, but we just happen to have the right substance? It's called Soylent Green, and you'll never have to worry about, getting sick.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. It's been a fascinating hour. Steve, I want to thank you so very much for coming on and being with us. And it's been a real pleasure, and I'd like to get you on our early morning program, too. I think we already have you lined up for that. Steve is on opposite me in the afternoon, so we can't share that time, but at least Steve was good enough to come on this evening. His information is important. Go to his website, that's stevequayle.com, and get the information. Help us to get it out, and I'm looking forward to getting his book. I think you should, too. Thanks so much for being with us, Steve.
Good night, Dr. Stan.
Good night, and God bless. Okay, fine. Well, I hate to be a bearer of bad news, but there really are evil and wicked people out there. The CIA got started in 1953 with these experiments. Steve is probably right. This is far larger than the CIA. The CIA works along with MI6 and works with the Mossad. And yes, they all work with Syrian intelligence. All the intelligence organizations of the world are interlocked. And behind them is the spiritual hierarchy, a demonic hierarchy. I was just this evening reading a material that's put out by the World Goodwill Group, and they talk about the spiritual hierarchy that rules the world, the Ancients of Wisdom, the Senior Brothers, the Great White Brotherhood. These are all demonic entities. They're real. And, of course, these people are in constant contact with them. They are channeling their ideas to our scientists and to our leaders, and many of our leaders embrace this other religion, the religion of the dark side. Now, you really need to understand this. You need to read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. You need to read Constance Cumby's excellent book, The Hidden Dangers of the Rainbow. You need to get our 4-tape set on the pagan agenda. You need to get our 4-tape set on Aleister Crowley and his friends, and on Satanism and deliverance. We're not simply talking about obtuse ideas. We're not talking about theoretical ideas. This is the reality of what's going on today. We're involved in a spiritual battle. There really are demonic forces in the world. All you need to do is go back and read the Bible and remember when Jesus encountered the demoniac there at Gerizim on the east side of the Sea of Galilee, and instances time and again where the apostles would come into contact with people who were demonically possessed, and we were warned not to be involved with divination and certainly mediums and other people, witches and that sort. And yet we have Hillary Clinton calling a medium into the White House, Jean Houston, to conjure up the spirits of Eleanor Roosevelt and Mohandas Gandhi. We have Nancy Reagan going to an astrologer to get advice for her president so Ronald Reagan could rule America. And these dark spirits of forces permeate every aspect of our society today, and nobody's going to talk about them. Well, we talk about them here because you can't understand the evil that is out there. And you can't understand the Nazi movement unless you understand it was founded in the occult. You can't understand the leadership of both of our parties, political parties here in the United States, who are so intent upon opening up our borders and transferring our wealth to other countries and building up the economy of communist China, and an instance recently where a Chinese diplomat, the highest ranking Chinese diplomat ever to defect to the West in Australia, and the Australians won't take him. And the United States government won't take this man, and to be sent back, you know, be tortured and is killed, and his family would be tortured and killed. And the Australians and the American government want to send him back. Why do you think we want to send back the Cubans who are trying to escape? And if they can't get their feet on dry land, why we send them back to Cuba to be tortured? It is because of the evil that exists in our society today. You need to understand that communism has been financed since its inception from the United States. And if you haven't read the book, Foundations, Their Power and Influence, you need to get it. Brotherhood of Darkness, The Hidden Dangers of the Rainbow. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Our website, RadioLiberty.com. Pray for America. Pray for revival. Please pray for Radio Liberty. Until tomorrow, may the Lord be with you.